Now, if you listen to us on the wireless, in the radio, in the car or what have you over the last couple of weeks, you might have noticed that the signal wasn't where it should be at, and it was a technical issue outside of our control, but a complex one. And I know from my own experience that it has been mostly resolved now. So if you normally listen to Highland in the car, but dependent on where you are, it was a wee bit ropey, that should be returned for you now. So get back on listening, just in case you were discouraged from doing so. As I say, outside of our control, but all up and running now, from my own experience. Kieran, Matthew White, Kieran, good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining me.
How are you getting on, Greg?
I'm doing good. It's a frustrating one, this, Kieran, and I really do appreciate you speaking to us about this because, you know, we're talking about the need for housing and the demand for housing versus supply. You've got a bloody nice house ready to go. What's the situation?
Situation is three bed house in the middle of Fulcara there, fully refurbed, oil heating, stove, 500 yards from the centre of the town. But looking to rent it or lease it to the council long term, and been informed, tried different angles on it, came out, inspected it back last year. They were happy with the house, but they're telling me that there's nobody in the Fulcara area at the minute looking to qualify for council housing, that everyone is accommodated privately and there's no need for it.
So there is no demand. And is it the house?
No demand.
Is it the house or the amount of bedrooms or the layout of the house or what?
There's no demand, that everyone that's on the council list looking or qualifying for a three-bed house. And it doesn't need to be Fulcara as such.
Or the hinterland.
I was just listening to your caller this morning. So, you know, maybe I'm missing something, but I think listening to your show, they're saying there's a housing crisis. Councillors are on saying they don't have enough houses. They're telling me then that there's houses being built in Fulcara that'll be finished by end of 25 that are going to qualify, that'll cover every need that's there, which I find it hard to believe that they're going to be built in the next year, but I don't know. I just thought I'd put it out there to see.
And Kieran, I'm not asking a private question, don't get me wrong, but is there a particular reason why you decided to offer this to the council rather than, I suppose, to the open rental market? Is it just a bit of stability you wanted in it?
That's exactly right. Okay. So I'd be willing to give a 10-year lease. So it's not something that, you know, in 6 months' time I'm going to decide I'm going to sell the house. I'd be happy to sign a 10-year lease to the council. It's a long term. It's just security of it, really.
Yeah, no, I get you.
We can go down the private route, and I know there is a demand for the private route, but I'd rather go this route.
No, and you've been told that apparently there's no housing crisis in Fulcara at all. There's no one in Fulcara or the surrounding areas that's waiting on a house that could avail of your three-bed, fully refurbed property in the heart of Fulcara.
Well, within walking distance to school town, so you don't even need transport.
That's remarkable. And once that decision is made, is that it? Or do they say, right, we're on a list if anything comes up? You're on a list, sorry. If anything comes up, we'll make contact.
Well, it's out there. Nobody's come back to me on it. I left it open. The house is still empty. So nobody's come back inquiring about it. Spoke to a few different councillors, etc., but they've all come back with the same response.
Did the conversation with the council ever turn to money? Like, was that on the table or...?
No. No, money was an issue. It was basically they told me to just quote the market value in the area, which I'd be happy enough with.
Yeah, exactly. So there was no problem there.
It's not an issue. We haven't even got down to that.
It's remarkable, Kieran. It's a remarkable story. Not the first one I've heard either, but I mean, that has...
Just looking a bit
like
of clarity to see... Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, Kieran, listen, we'll make our inquiries on your behalf. I just find it hard to believe that there's not a family that would, on the council list, that would happily move to Fulcara to avail of this type of property.
It doesn't have to be Fulcara.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. Great to learn these things. It does give us an insight into what's going on, Kieran. Maybe there's more to it from the council's perspective, but we'll see if we can find out.
We'll see.
Thanks for your time, Kieran.
Thanks,
Take care
Greg.
Of yourself. All right, there you go. Absolutely remarkable. House is lying there. Three-bed lying there, empty in Fulcara, fully refurbed. But Kieran says he's been told by the council that there ain't no demand for it at the moment. Hi, Greg. I think O'Leary is taking the mickey out of TDs as usual. As far as I know, the last few leaders have been teachers, Enda Kenny and Micheál Martin, to mention a few, and still they haven't done anything about class sizes. That comes in from Kevin. Yeah, that's actually interesting, Kevin. Maybe Maybe they are. A caller says, I saw the Starlink satellites in the sky in Letterkenny about 20 past six last night. Just wondering if anyone else saw them. Yep, they did. A few people saw them because I was contacted on Facebook. Not everyone knows about the Starlink sort of setup. That's Elon Musk's company. But they launch, and wherever they launch or however they launch, that's just about the time that they cross low in the orbit so we see them. And it's quite unusual because they're in a perfect line, these little satellites that he's using to provide broadband to places not supplied by it or those that are. And that's his satellite network. And it's kind of interesting too, because I noticed that some astronomers are saying that their ability to see far out into the galaxy is being hindered by the noise of these satellites in their telescopes and what have you. But anyway, there's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of them up there. Patsy Kelly's with me now. He's a former SDLP councillor, as you might know, independent councillor in Strabane and on Derry Council. Good morning to you, Patsy. Thanks for your time.
Not too bad, Greg. How are you?
I'm all right. You were flying out of Derry recently, and your experience is one that you're prepared to share in case it helps other people. What's the story?
Well, I did share it on Friday. On Friday, we were flying to Edinburgh. So it was basically flying to Edinburgh, and I've used EasyJet before. I've only used them about maybe 3 or 4 weeks beforehand, flying over into Manchester with work. And the same luggage that I use all the time on and off the planes there. In Derry, the first thing that happened was they said our bag was too big for the cabin, which I used it with an EasyJet flight 4 weeks before, and there was no issue. And they wanted, well, they had to, we had to pay £48
wow.
one way. And the plane was two-thirds empty.
Is this like your average sort of 10-kilogram bag, Patsy, that, you know, the square ones that we might
just
be familiar
a small,
with?
Yeah, less than 10 kg, small yeah. bag.
But the shape
which,
one?
Yeah, just a square-shaped one that's been used yeah. all the time with EasyJet, any time we flew with them at all. And this time in out of Derry, £48. One girl didn't even let us have a speak to ask why. It just was £48 and you're not getting it on, and she started looking at other bags. And then we get on the plane. Before we get on the plane, we were told by other EasyJet staff there's inconsistencies in other airports the way this is policed. Mm. Because we came back today and no issue. But rather than the safeguarding, we paid an extra £22 just in case where this came out of for luggage. But my fact is, whatever we all normally think that a small bag, which normally what you use all the time on a plane, is now becoming, they want you almost to something just very, very, very small.
But Patsy, is there a risk that you could land up there tomorrow or Wednesday or Thursday or whenever the next flight is, and it's different staff
yeah.
and it might not be enforced?
Yes. Well, this is what one of the staffers, one or two airline staff said, there's inconsistency, which my fear is, when we get out, I thought, right, this plane must be packed. They're two-thirds empty getting into Edinburgh on Friday, and we had paid her for the seats we wanted and everything up at the front, and then we were charged for this bag, which I had told them, or I tried to tell them I was on an EasyJet flight. I could even show them the booking reference the last flight I was on. No issues, same bag. And I was out of London on Monday there, last Monday as well, and same bag, no issues, but with a different airline.
Yeah,
you know,
caller just message.
So I just wanted to watch the
same
because,
problem yesterday,
you know,
from Birmingham. So it's not just Derry. Someone in Birmingham got hit with the 48.
£48. You know, this is something that's been your catching.
How much was the flight? How much is a flight?
The flight was roughly, but the flight was only £58.
My word!
So it was a return. You know, it was great for a lovely weekend, but the fact is, there's stinging us at the airport. You know. And they're blaming EasyJet. Yes, nothing to do with Derry and Strabane District Council who run the airport at the moment. But £48 is not the money. It's the principle of the thing. You know, how many other people is going to be caught like
it
this?
It is the money, you know? Though. I'll tell you one thing. I've headed away. If I was heading, say, to Edinburgh or whatever, at a time where you'd budget, I don't know, right, I'm going to spend 150 sterling or whatever it might be. You know yourself. And to have 50 taken out of that as you depart is a big old hit. I mean, you're not far off booking a seat for your bag and sitting it beside you. Do you know that sort of way? That's the that's almost where you're at. Crazy stuff. All right.
Well, we had four seats booked, but one of the other people that was coming with us took sick and couldn't come, so we had a spare seat. But we had to pay £48 for the bag. So just anybody be wary that there is an issue there, and an inconsistent one that's not been dealt with by EasyJet, you know, themselves.
Okay, yeah. When the staff themselves are saying that, was it? Was it just a wee leisure trip, Patsy?
It was just a weekend in Edinburgh to see a partner's family.
Okay, right.
It's colder, a lot colder than here, but dry, beautiful, and just meeting up with my partner's family.
Brilliant.
And it was lovely, a lovely weekend, and Edinburgh's a lovely city to come out. Much handier coming out of Derry, yes, but that took the sting of it before we even got on the flight.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But
I'm asking you for selfish reasons, because it seems, you know, to be able to hop over to Scotland from Derry, it's a great thing. Shame about this bit of negative publicity, because it's great to have these connections, isn't it? I think there's a flight to
Liverpool.
It's
brilliant to have the connections, you know, and that was the only sting in the tail, that. But the rest was fantastic. So saving you having to drive to Belfast or anything like that,
for sure.
You know, to Edinburgh, which is a popular city and a lovely city.
All right, well, let's see. We'll get a quote from EasyJet. I'm sure they've already issued one. We'll see what they have to say. But for now, Patsy, thank you very much indeed. Patsy Kelly, so what's your experience been with EasyJet and the carry-on bag that you would expect to be able to take on with you? Maybe, Shannon, if you don't mind, you might go onto the website and just go into the as if you were booking a flight, and just see what the baggage allowance is on the website, if you don't mind. That might be quite interesting. I mean, they might say you can't take one of those, but it's a bit of an expectation, isn't it? Okay. Teachers tend to be overrepresented in the Dáil due to the nature of the job with career breaks. The last economic crash, however, was due to the banking and business sector, not the average teacher. I mean, teachers work hard. I wouldn't want to be involved in any teacher bashing, because I know there's, you know, when you look at jobs, like you see people do different jobs that you could or couldn't do, or wouldn't do, or just wouldn't be fit to do. I'll tell you, teaching would be one I would, I don't think I'd excel at. So I have a lot of respect for them. Greg, it'd be interesting to get the number of teachers who are in the Dáil at the moment. I'm no fan of O'Leary, but he has a point. We need more teachers. Let's see if we can find that out. There's more, a lot of landlords in the Dáil. I don't know if that surprises you. A couple of comments coming in, not in specific relation to any case we've been talking about today. And this is not man-bashing either. But a lot of times people are struggling with accommodation or whatever it might be. And as I say, this is not in relation to anything we've talked about today. So I want to be very clear on that. And wondering, you know, are fathers present enough in some of these situations in terms of supporting their children and the mother of their children? As I say, that's not in relation to anything specific today. It's off the back of a separate comment, and I'm trying to word it differently so it's not associated with an earlier piece. But I don't know if you think there's something to that. Maybe you're a woman who is of that view, or a fella for that matter. Accommodation in this county is absolutely buggered. We were in a similar situation at the start of the year, a family of five with number six on the way. We rented a house for nearly 10 years. Owners decided to sell up, had to move out. I earned slightly too much to qualify for support, and thus have been completely priced out of Letterkenny and still paying double what I was paying in my old house. Up to now, 60% of my salary a month. 60% with a family of six on rent. Okay. Okay, I'll just come back to that one. I don't know what that one's about. Hi, Greg. Great to see Michael O'Leary and Fine Gael showing their true colours. They all want yes men and prefer slave labour and do not have critical thinking skills and no sense of entitlement to a good work-life balance and moral substance. Keep it going, teachers. Ireland needs you. The coalition must really believe that the people of Donegal are stupid. It was next to impossible to get a minister up here over recent years, but now when it's in their own best interests, we can't keep them away. But then what I will say, I get where you're coming from, but you could then argue they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. If they don't, it's like, oh, what's going on? That would be me. Oh, what's going on? You never come up here. And then they do, you go, oh, well, you never come up here and now you do. So I do have a bit of sympathy that, as I say, you couldn't win either way. Good morning. Just tuned into your station this morning for the first time. My local station is Shannonside. Just taking a break from Joe Finnegan today. Kind regards, Tommy. Cheers, Tommy. I haven't listened to Joe myself. Why are you taking a break? Supposed to know. I'll mix it up a little bit. Good to have you on board here anyway. Right, Dominic O'Donnell's with me now. Dominic, thanks for joining us on the programme this morning.
How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Okay, so your son and four of his mates flew over, I presume, was it to watch Liverpool Aston Villa? Was that the game they went over for?
No, it was the Liverpool-Leverkusen game on Tuesday.
Right, on Tuesday evening. Past, okay. Right, so what was their experience?
Well, they've worked all summer and saved up for a European game, so they booked everything themselves. And everything was going good until they landed in Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
And they went in to check into the hotel. So when they were checking in, they asked one of the boys what age he was, and he said he was 17, maybe 18 in a couple of days. And they turned around and told them that they couldn't check in. And they says, could you not ring our parents just to verify all this? And wouldn't do nothing. They asked for the manager. The manager wouldn't come down to speak to them. And they just put them on the street, basically. And they phoned four or five hotels before they rang me.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were panicking then because they thought they were going to be out in the street because the hotels they'd rang was all booked, fully booked out. So I just went on to booking.com and I seen an apart hotel. And I sent it on to them. But they were afraid of losing more money by booking online. So they found another place themselves and they walked down to it and they met a woman there and they told her that I was double booked just in case they wouldn't get booked in.
Mm-hmm.
So she says, oh, I can't have anybody standing on the streets. And she got them a place and looked after them now.
Right.
And I spoke to that woman since, and she was appalled by the way they were treated, and she says, like, they can stay there anytime, anymore, when they go over, like.
All right, Stephen Sharkey, you're one of the lads. Hi, Stephen.
How's it going, Greg?
I'm doing right, buddy. So you landed in Liverpool Tuesday morning, was it?
Tuesday morning, aye.
All right, and the game was that night, wasn't it, against Leverkusen? What was it like when you went into the hotel and you were told, no, you can't stay here? I presume you were all very responsible lads. You know, you were in there, you weren't causing any trouble. You just wanted somewhere to sleep after the match.
We were just trying to check in and your man wasn't getting the manager and what we asked, so.
And would they reason with you at all? Like, did you say, look, if you don't let us stay here, what they weren't interested in your welfare, I take it?
No, not really, no.
All right, okay. And obviously very relieved then when you got into accommodation. What time was that about at?
That was about 5 o'clock, yeah.
Right, so didn't leave you much time then to get to the ground and all that. You did get to see the game, I take it?
Yeah, just about then.
But it was all a bit of a rush. All right, cheers for that. Michael, you're there too. Michael, how are you getting on?
Yes, Greg, how's it going?
I'm all right. It's been a good wee run for Liverpool, of course, but for a time, I'd say you were pretty worried, pretty desperate in Liverpool. No roof, nowhere to stay.
Oh, we were very worried now when we landed at the hotel. We were just in shock. We didn't know what to do or where we were going. We were afraid to book another hotel then in case, you know, they wouldn't let us in.
Yeah.
The same hotel didn't let us in, so we didn't know whether we should book a hotel and lose more money, and we just hadn't a clue, so we thought it'd be better off going to that lovely woman. I have to say, she was very, very kind to us, and
I think
we went
she
to her
have,
and she says,
"Yeah, she must have had kids of her own, or understood." I know you're not kids; you're just 17. Nah, don't
no,
get me wrong,
Michael. She was very, very nice. Now, in fairness,
yeah, all right, and put yous up.
No, she was very nice, but
and yous obviously were very respectful because yous have that place to go back to anytime yous want to. I hear.
Oh, that's it. I know it, mate. It was a lovely apartment too. You know,
yeah.
It was just right in the city centre, hey.
Brilliant.
And there was no fuss about it.
Fantastic. It's good to know. And you've got to see the match anyway. A 4-0 win, I think it was on Tuesday, wasn't it?
Aye, also a brilliant game. We had the hospitality tickets too, you see. So
right.
We were in the ground from about 7. So, it was great. We were so glad then because we weren't really looking forward to the game then when we knew where to stay. We were like, oh, geez.
What are we going
to
do?
We would rather have a roof over our heads than actually go to the game at that stage.
Great.
And, you know, we found the hotel then, and sure, we were
we're looking forward to the
well
game.
Well done, lads. And it was a good game. Another good win on Saturday as well. So all's good in that regard. And once you got in contact with that lady, you were able to switch off the nightmare of the day earlier on and just enjoy the match, the 5 years, which is great.
Yeah.
All right, good stuff. Well done. And just finally back to you, Dominic. Obviously, two lovely lads. I'm sure they all were. It's no harm maybe just to let people know that this can happen.
Yeah, because, like, the whole lot of them, they're in leaving cert and they're at the age now where they're going to venture out themselves. Yeah. And, like, they can book flights, they can fly, and not to get into a hotel at that age. They can all drive cars.
But even if one of them had to, even if the hotel said, right, lads, we're going to have to get one of your parents' debit card or credit cards just in case. You know, say, for instance, it was down to, not that they ever would, but, you know, as a security for the hotel or something. But anyway, as you say, they can fly, they can get into the football match, but they can't put their head down in Liverpool. Very bad form. Thanks for that, Dominic. That's Dominic O'Donnell and Stephen and Michael. Again, might not be a situation that will ever apply to you, but maybe it is something that's coming up. Just to, a word to the wise. And it's not just Liverpool, by the way. I have heard similar stories elsewhere. Paul Williams has a new book out. It's called Crux, the stories behind the headlines. And Paul's with me now. Hiya, Paul. Good morning to you. 1 second. Sorry, Paul. I don't have your fade.
Shows up there in lovely Donegal.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't have your fader up here because I'm sitting here with your... I was leaving through your book with the fader down. Sorry, you were saying about lovely Donegal. I'll give you an opportunity to reiterate that.
I said hello to all your listeners in beautiful Donegal, which is almost as nice as Leitrim, but we stop it there, okay?
Do you know what? The Northwest, we're all family up here, aren't we? We all share most of the same lovely scenery and the same problems. Okay, so 14...
We were always the poor cousins.
Exactly, that's it, Paul. So you've been at this for four decades. It's just reflecting on your career, Paul, it's a toughie, right? Is it worth it? Was it all worth it? I know you're still at it, but you know, reflecting on 4 years, it's a different type of journalism. There's more of you in it, I think, to some extent.
Well, yes. Well, you know, you asked that question, and it's a good question. People asked me that for many, many years. It's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is was it worth it? And I ended up getting myself in a huge amount of trouble and then obviously put my own family in peril. But it's not a decision you make when you set out. And my very first crime story I covered, as I said in the book, was 40 years ago on the side of a mountain in Leitrim in 1984. But when I started, the first threats I got, serious death threats, came through the police, were in 1994. But then 10 years later, I had a bomb scare and much more serious even death threats at that stage. But the point about it is that it's an incremental process that you gradually... very gradually find yourself in that situation. And remember along that journey, you know, through the years too, but like I said at the book launch last week, that there's not many professions you can be in, apart from maybe being the army and the guards, whereby you can say that two of your colleagues and friends were shot dead in the line of duty. Mm. And also you get to know a lot of people who have been murdered and people that you liked. So, you know, that's a distinction that crime journalists have compared to any other journalist. And so it was to put the story, when I started writing the book, I started with the General, when we first chased after the General, when I came to Dublin first working with the Sunday World. And I didn't know where it was going to bring me. And then I started going through like a voyage behind the scenes. I suppose in many ways, it's reminding to the readers that there's a very, very dark side to the headlines you read about in the paper, as in you read a very dark story about very brutal people like the Psycho or the Westies or any of these people, or the General. But that there's another side to the story. There's the dark side of the messenger who tries to bring you the story and what happens behind the scenes to them. And it's only when I reflected and was sitting in a cabin at the back of my house writing the stuff that it sort of came together in that I used to say, sit back and go, Jesus, did all that happen? And like at one stage in 2003, I ended up with an episode of post-traumatic stress because that year culminated in a bomb scare at my home and an acid attack on my car. But in that process, that whole year, I was being told by the guards from NBCI, the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation, came to see me. I was being threatened by Martin Foley, the Viper, and his criminal gang. Then I was threatened by associates of his, but then the INLA and a sort of a disparate group, which included the likes of Christy Kinahan advising them, and different groups came together, and they had a much more serious plan. Like Martin Foley, the Viper, tried to harass me and intimidate me. But the other gang, this other group that came together, and that was being warned about it, they were going to try and lure, and they did try to lure me out into meetings. I literally, that's what you do as a journalist, you go out and meet contacts, and suddenly I couldn't meet people because I was being warned by the police, these guys are going to try and lure you into a trap. And until we get control on the situation, we advise, don't do anything because they'd kill you. Mm-hmm. And all of that was coming hard and fast. And then at the same time, by the way, this particular year, 2003, which I talk about in the book is the year of living dangerously. Like, we also had the then Minister for Justice on our case because he was bringing in the 2005 Garda Síochán Act, and he was planning it. And one of the provisions in that was to make it a criminal offence for a guard to talk to a journalist. Now, it was a very blunt instrument, but he came out all guns blazing when a journalist in a national newspaper basically attacked crime journalists and said he could name five journalists who were paying guards for information, which are completely and utterly untrue, and which he literally had to completely retract, because the only people who were dealing with cops were crime journalists. And a campaign was launched. We all, the crime journalists at the time, had to come out and publicly state, you know, this is outrageous. And then McDougall endorsed that for the first time. And so then that validated in the eyes of the criminals, said, yes, these crime journalists are only thugs and scumbags just like us, and we'll go after them. And I was the most high profile of the lot of them at the time. And they were already after me. So it was like, I became sort of like fair game. So that particular year was really, really crazy. And it resulted with the state placing myself and my family under 24, under the equivalent of Witness Protection Program. We had a full-time 24/7, 365 police armed and uniformed presence at our home, which lasted for well over 10 years. And then at the same time, I also was provided with, the state provided with me, I didn't ask for them, provided me with two armed members of Garda Special Branch, who everywhere I went for over 2 years, literally were with me. Every time I looked in the rear view mirror, there was an escort car driving behind me. If I went anywhere, say, we went to a wedding one time up in Harvey's Point, up there in beautiful Donegal, for our nephew, and that was an example of whereby we were going up there, so we were going to stay in Leitrim the night before and drive up. So the police had to go through this. So every time we went somewhere, there was a convoluted situation whereby, you know, they had to contact the chief superintendent in Sligo, Leitrim, because I was staying in Leitrim for a night, because they would have to put armed protection on at the house when my own bodyguards went off duty, so to speak. And then they had to alert the PSNI that I was going into Enniskillen to go to the wedding. And then they had to alert the chief in Donegal to tell him I was going up to his wedding and Harvey's Point was going to be staying. Like, you felt that you were... You felt that you were a bloody nuisance yourself because all of this logistics were going on. And it was literally like the same as being in the Witness Protection Program.
Did they ever
and that
have
was
to,
done because they thought it would kill me.
I beg your pardon, sorry, Paul. Did they ever have to intervene? Either the 24-hour protection on the home or the Gardaí that were with you. Did they ever intercept anything happening to you?
They did indeed, yeah. There was one example, like my son was coming in one night back, a few years ago. He was coming home one night and he spotted a guy standing sort of like looking suspiciously out on the road. We're just in off the road in Rafarnham, and he thought he twigged the guy. He reckoned it was Martin Foley, the Viper, and like there was a guard at the house, so he came in, but the guards then spotted him looking through the gates. There was gates which he thought he couldn't be seen, and there was a big alert and he was pulled in. There was another time when he and his associates arrived at my son's school in Turner College, and the school, the principal and the teachers were brilliant. They were always very, very conscious that Jake was there and that there may be a security matter. And when they saw him making his rambling around the school grounds, which he had no business to be there, they called the guards and they locked down the whole school and pulled him in to find out what he was up to. There was another time.
What they were trying to achieve at that time, their job was probably done, right? Because it's about intimidating you, and if they can't get to you, you try and get to those around you. And this is all chronicled in the book, and this is where we get the insight from this new book. Then that's different, isn't it? Because you can make your own decisions as an adult, Paul, and you can make your calls as an adult. But then, and you've talked about it already, and I'm sure we'll read more about it then it's how it starts impacting how your son or the rest of the family go about their life and living their lives, looking over their shoulders. That's where I would really start struggling.
Absolutely. And as I say to you, it creeps up to you. And I've said, I'll use the line in the book, it just came spontaneously to me when I was writing. I was like, I suddenly found myself in a dark and very demented world where all of this was happening. And I the lowest point was the night that they planted a hoax, very elaborate hoax device at my home and my car. And it was designed purely to intimidate and turn me into a pariah. And the police were superbly professional that night. It was amazing. They took us out of the house, they took myself and my wife, and she and my son went in one squad car, and I and myself and my daughter went in another car to brought us to the station. But the big problem with all of that was that they then had to evacuate. When the bomb squad came and looked at the device, they evacuated the entire road, 150 people at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. It was horrendous. And yes, that when that happens, I was looking at my family in the police station saying, like, just all I could say was sorry. And then with my neighbours, I felt ashamed that I caused them so much trouble. There was one poor man who had had testicular cancer. And when I was in the Garda station and I rang some of the guards who were up evacuating the place, and the reason the bomb squad evacuated the place, because when they x-rayed the device, they said it was a professional, proper, lethal and legitimate device. But I could hear this man, the guard, saying, pick up your daughter, you have to move. But the poor man, even though he looked well, he was very unwell, and he couldn't pick up his child. And I could happen just to hear that in the background. And I felt absolutely, the world you want just to swallow you up.
Yeah.
And then when the police did arrive, and when they were put full time, at least there was never a burglary on the road after that. It was the one small thing I could do to make up to my neighbours, you know.
Paul,
horrible. It was horrible.
I can imagine. Right. So I can understand just during the most dangerous of times, right? It's very easy to sort of to determine a threat to you or a risk level to you, right? But, you know, a lot of these people have long memories, and a lot of them could still be behind bars and feel that you were very much a part of that. So as time goes on, how is the threat level determined? Is it not more difficult to sort of... I mean, I'm sure some of these threats to you have never passed. So how is that all determined, if you know what I mean? Because there could be people waiting in the long grass, so to speak, who can't wait to get revenge on something you've written or an article that eventually maybe led to their incarceration.
But you have that. But, of course, age and maturation, as they say, takes hold, and they sort of cop themselves on. But, like, I haven't been on frontline crime reporting for some years now.
Yeah, I get that.
Radio
yeah.
and all of that kind of stuff. And, the expose is, like, I'm now a sort of seen as an expert in the area because I commentate it, and as a criminologist, I talk about it and do lectures on it. But the point about it is that, you know, I understand what they do, how they think. I understand the psychology. Yes, there may be a few guys there who might maybe have long memories. Like, I had a really long, difficult time with the INLA, basically because I stood up to the bastards. They were a bunch of bully boy thugs. In the end of the day, by the way, one thing I would never do, Greg, is I never apologize for doing my job. Because when we were getting the serious stress and trouble from these guys, the one thing that we always agreed on, and he included my family, was that if we back down, these people infest other people's lives. Think of Steve Collins in Limerick. Look what he went through. He's a very close friend of mine. And I knew his son, Roy. And I got to know them years before Roy was murdered. And I held his hand because he was my friend. And when you look at what he went through, I went through nothing. So I have an obligation and a duty of care to help him. And there's so many other people like that. And there's also then the other people, Greg, there's no such thing as impartiality in this business. Because a thug is a thug. If somebody goes into your life and tries to infest it and destroy it and undermine it, then that bastard needs to be made as difficult as possible for them. Remember as well, two of my colleagues have been murdered. So that sort of fuels, colours your view on the world. You can't back down against them. And our little bit, by writing about them, it was a little bit of justice for some people. It gave people a voice. And they, you know, they tried. And I would be very careful. I'm a natural-born security consultant almost now, because I'm so used to all the years of being security conscious. So I'm not going to ramble into places, even at this stage of my life, where I don't know and can't control the environment, so to speak.
Yeah, I get you. And what have you. But Paul, just in relation to the job that you did, I mean, obviously now, what the general public would see, some of the major players in crime, it's there in your face. You know, people will be tracking the Kinahan's movements and that story and the government efforts to extract them back and all that kind of stuff. But there's an awful lot of crime ongoing at a lower level, right? I'm not asking you actually, by the way, to criticise your colleagues or anything like that, but do we still see the same level of crime reporting and investigative journalism where you get right into the nitty-gritty of what's happening right now and you're taking on, you know, the generals of 2024 and otherwise? I don't be exposed to an awful lot of it, but I know you'd keep an eye on it. I'm just wondering how important, it clearly was a very important role during the times most listening are familiar with. Do we still see that now? Is there a gap there? Is it gone forever?
Well, and that's absolutely no reflection on my colleagues. I've talked to the younger colleagues, and I think it's outrageous that they have to go through such an extraordinary, have to act like almost like international spies to do stories now. And that's thanks to this 2005 Garda Síochán Act brought in by Michael McDougall. And as well as that, we have, and I've said this very publicly, and I've said it many, many times, and I've written this narrative, and we have the worst Garda Commission in the history of the state. We have a man who came in here who's a very good man, a great man of integrity, but a man who hasn't got a bloody clue about Irish culture or how Irish people are and the relationship to have with a Garda Síochán. They have now got to a situation where a guard at the highest rank, and this is now a professional organisation with highly qualified, capable people, and they don't have the confidence in themselves to stand and say hello or talk to a journalist publicly, because they're terrified of their lives, that they too would be suspended by this suspender. That's what he seems to be more. And like you saw, 99% of An Garda Síochán, when they voted no quite confidence remarkable. In their commissioner, that's unprecedented, Greg. And the reason it's unprecedented is because, and like, I'd say Mary, our Minister for Justice, Helen McAtee, is a very nice person, but she is not up to the job, and she could have grabbed the nettle. I know it's difficult, but if 99% of your rank and file, the people that we expect to protect us day to day in our normal lives, the thin, very thin blue line is completely demoralised, angry, and walking out the door in large numbers. You have to look around and see for scapegoat. And the two scapegoats to me are the Minister for Justice, Helen McAtee, and the previous Minister for Justice, and Drew Harris. The people on Garda Síochán are holding their breath and marking down like prisoners in a cell. You know the way they mark the wall for each day that passes. Mm-hmm. What people are doing that all over.
Well, people can track that themselves with the resignations and retirements, the monthly bulletin that's out there. Right. Okay. So that's Paul Williams, author of Crooks: The Stories Behind the Headlines. If you're interested in crime and the stories behind the crimes that you're familiar with, Paul wrote many of them, but do you want an insight as to how he got those scoops and what impact they might have? And also, as we've been talking about, the high price one has to pay for that line of work, but also other people that you've pursued, become engaged with. Paul, it's all there in this book. It is familiar to readers of your book, but there's more of you in this than previous books.
Well, there is. It is very much a personal thing, you know. Like, for example, just as before ago, like it's ironic that this morning Jojo Dollard's been missing for 29 years. Yeah. The man has finally been arrested. Like I write a chapter about how I spent 2 years literally tracking Larry Murphy around Europe, and it was very exciting. But like one thing, for example, just before I go, I remember we were following him one time in Amsterdam secretly. Mm. We had a surveillance on him for something like a month before we decided to move in and confront him. But like I was getting phone calls from people in Leitrim, people in Donegal, people in Sligo, my part of the world, saying that, you know, we saw Larry Murphy there in Buncrana. And people were starting to see these false sightings that were being fueled by social media. Somebody was going to get killed. But that was because he was the ultimate bogeyman. And I always took great pleasure in that, because in the sense that we could expose to the public and show the public, by the way, don't be afraid of the bogeyman. He's not there. He's in downtown Amsterdam working here, and he's living with this person and that person. And there was a great pleasure in that, just making their lives difficult. You know, I tell the story about John O'Neill, the man who knew, he's known as the former FBI agent, who became a great friend of mine, and he was killed. He was the world's foremost expert on Osama bin Laden. He left the FBI. He was forced out of the FBI 1 month before the attack on 9/11, and he got a job where, as head of security in the World Trade Center, I spoke to him about a week before the attack in the World Trade Center. And ultimately, the ultimate irony was, and tragic irony was, that poor John O'Neill, FBI man, was killed by the man who he had tracked for years, Osama bin Laden.
And he saw it coming.
Yeah, that's the point. He's Owen in America is the man who knew. Jeff Daniels played him in a movie called The Looming Tower some years ago. And it was a pleasure and honour to say that he was a friend of mine. And he was one of the foremost. He was the reason I got to know him was because he was involved in the hunt for dissidents and the dissident Republican investigations that were going on here in the following the peace process. And he was very, very much in that because he was a counter-terrorism expert. And I met him through Pat Burdigar, the commissioner, and we became very good friends. And I've never been able to get over the fact. And most of American people, the FBI and all those places, can't get over how tragically ironic it was that the man who warned, and he even said it the night before, he says something's going to happen. And it did happen. And what happened was his first major crisis in the job, less than 2 weeks into it, was his last. He was killed in the North Tower. You know, it was. And to be part of that and to witness all of that is sort of like, you know, when you look back on it, it's quite an emotional drain, and you wonder how the hell you stuck with all, handle all that.
Of
crap,
course,
you know?
But what's not unique, but what is different for a lot of people, the crime and the stories of crime and the personalities involved in it almost seems fictional. And I think with types of, you know, with the programs like Love Hate and others as well, and other stuff you see coming out from Hollywood, sometimes it's hard to differentiate between what's real and what's not real. And in our minds, subconsciously, we forget that the characters that you interacted with are very, very real. And we have access to you alive writing a book where we can sort of get more of an insight into that and a sense of that reality. And
there's a very good line. There's a very good line that sums up all of this. And I've been saying this all my life. As I say, I'm just turning 60 now. And I survived. But I always make the point that the truth is much stranger than fiction. Like, there's things that happen, you say, Jesus Christ, you couldn't make this up. You know that term? And I've had more experiences like that through the years. Of so many cases that you come across. And also, I do know, for example, when Love Hate was being shown, remember Love Hate?
Yes, of course.
I knew the guys who are doing consulting on that. And I was watching programs, and I knew exactly the trajectory, and I knew where it was all going, because that was a brilliantly scripted. Stuart Carlin did a great job on that, but because he consulted the people who knew. And I would know and recognize the characters, and I recognize where I could predict where the trajectory of each character's plot story line was, because I've seen it all before. And the same thing today, like one of the last things I'll say to you before I go, because of the prevalence of cocaine in our society, organized crime is more embedded in society now than it's ever been at any stage and ever will be, because in every village and town in rural Ireland, right through Donegal, Leitrim, everywhere, there is a local cocaine dealer. That means that there is a local criminal giving out, selling this crap. Because, by the way, let me tell you, it looks white and fluffy, but it is the most dangerous substance there is. It's sent domestic violence and domestic abuse spiraling. It has sent mental health issues, addiction spiraling. And it's a hidden crisis that we have in our society. And it's the hidden crisis. There's a health implication, a psychological implication. It has a massive effect on society, on kids, parents, families. But then we also see the manifestation of that when people start taking guns and shooting each other dead because they want to take over and control. They're so greedy, they want to control the supply and the demand and the money that's coming into a village in Donegal or a town in Letterkenny or somewhere like that. That's the reality of crime.
It's not hard to see the connection because, you know, there's so much money in it and you want your own territory. You want to be the supplier for that area. So we can see very clearly. And as you say, cocaine is a horrendous issue in this county and elsewhere. Paul, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time.
I'm sure many will
enjoy reading your book. Paul Williams is the author of Crooks, the stories behind the headlines. It's just $16.99. There's a lot of work in it, and it's available. It's published by Allen and Unwin, and it's available in all the usual places where you might expect to see it. I love listening to Paul Williams. His stories are so fascinating because he's part of them. Times you think it's fiction because they're so scary and hard to believe they actually happened. Congrats, Paul, on your new book. Look forward to reading it. That comes in from Ava. Thank you very much for that. Fine Gael's proposal to cut the VAT rate for hospitality to 11% in the first 100 days of the next government is laughable, considering they had an opportunity to do this 4 weeks ago in the budget and didn't. It should be also noted that only last week Fine Gael rejected a Sinn Féin proposal to reduce the VAT rate to 9%. And I think that's... Is it Sinn Féin still committing to that? Well, this whole O'Leary story is a prime example of government media spin. Everyone knows it's a referral to Enda and other teachers who ran for election, but they're using it as a spin distraction. It was a Fine Gael event, don't forget. By the way, I'm not sure if it's tomorrow. I think it might be tomorrow, but I just heard some of the national analysis of how they think it's going to settle, the election's going to go here in Donegal. And listen, they could be right, but I think there's certainly maybe a lack of local knowledge and geography in some of the predictions. We're going to do the first of what's going to be a series of where are we at, I suppose, in terms of the general election. So we're going to have guests on tomorrow. If you're into this stuff, you're going to love it. We're going to sort of see where we think things are going at the moment, what could happen over the next wee while to change things. Could it be Fianna Fáil with two seats? Could it be Fianna Fáil with one seat or no seat? Or Sinn Féin with two or three or none? All right, so we're going to have that conversation tomorrow. Looking forward to that, and hopefully you are too. And we'll put it together as an individual podcast for those of you interested in that manner of thing. If you have any questions or comments in relation to that, let us know, 086 60 25,000. I just want to speak to those of you listening on podcast, by the way. Thank you so much for streaming it and downloading it every day. You can email or WhatsApp us your comments and we'll pick it up for the next show, and you can have it in that podcast, if you know what I mean. Or if you're listening overnight, as many of you do, and it's great to have you on board as well, feel free to WhatsApp or email, and we can carry your overnight comments into the daytime show, if that makes sense. But for me, Greg Hughes, Caroline Orr, who's ever present, researching and producing, and Shannon working on the show as well, have a wonderful Monday. Stay safe and stay tuned.